Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. Almost 45,000 Americans take their lives each year. Risk factors for suicide include depression, which as we know is a very common affliction, but also isolation, lack of access to mental health resources, substance abuse, and the feelings of stigma that still occur with seeking help for mental health. The medical profession is particularly rife with these risk factors, in addition to its practitioners having the knowledge and wherewithal to plan and execute suicide. The best estimates we have for suicide in the medical profession, which are assumed to be underreported, are that on average one physician a day in the United States takes his or her own life. Efforts are being made throughout the lengthy medical education process to improve recognition of the signs of mental suffering and address its difficulties. My guest today, Dr. Michael Myers, is a professor of clinical psychiatry at the State University of New York, downstate in Brooklyn. He's devoted his career to treating health professionals and written several books about providing care for this unique population. His latest book is called Why Physicians Die by Suicide: Lessons Learned from Their Families and Others Who Cared. Myers was haunted by the memory of a medical school roommate who took his own life, and appalled to find that the university made no effort at acknowledging the death or offering support to him and his classmates. It was a different era, and though the topic remains a sober and challenging one, Myers offers some notes of hope for changing a toxic educational culture. Dr. Mike Myers of SUNY Downstate is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Mike Myers, welcome to the program. I want to start by asking you about the problem with the number of doctors committing suicide. What can you give us a ballpark of how frequently this is occurring?
Well, what we know, and this is really just from one source, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, is that it's estimated that somewhere between 300 and 400 physicians die by suicide each year in the United States. And so that translates out to roughly one a day. And we don't know, of course, whether that is an underestimate. It might be, because in the world of suicidology, there are unexplained deaths sometimes that you can't really attribute to suicide, but it's a possibility. The other thing is that we don't know whether the numbers are going up or going down or staying the same. So,
and you make the point too, and I think I may have crisscrossed this, but help me out. So in terms of female physicians, so their rate of suicide exceeds that in the general population. Because it's essentially one-to-one with male physicians, but males have a higher suicide rate in general, so the physician rate is lower than the general population.
Well, no. The way it translates, if I understand, you know, what largely the way the epidemiologists categorize this, is that we male physicians have about a 1.5 or a slightly higher rate of suicide than men in general, whereas women have about a 2.5% higher rate than women in general. But in terms of the actual sort of comparison, it means that the death rate by suicide of men and women in medicine is roughly the same.
And it doesn't seem, you pointed out the issue with the trend, which is we don't really know what the trend is, because it doesn't seem like when we, I guess, survey medical residents, they seem to have fairly high rates of depression.
Right. We're finding that out in terms of studies of both medical students and residents and how those numbers, by the way, most of those are self-report scales as opposed to the numbers that actually consult somebody for treatment. And that's really complicated because of the fact that we know that the vast majority actually don't go for any help at all. And that's, of course, one of our main mandates here in the world of sort of physician health and well-being, is to do what we can to make it less stigmatizing to go for help, you know, when you're struggling with, well, depression just being one of the things while you're in training.
So one reason that a lot of healthcare professionals don't seek help is stigma, as you alluded to. So they're afraid of being labeled as perhaps having a mental illness or being depressed.
Yeah.
But another reason beyond the stigma is, and you raise this point, it's an issue with licensure. Can you explain that?
Yes. The whole idea of stigma is very complicated because in the book, I tried to break it down into the so-called subjective stigma. That's the perception that an individual has about himself or herself, that they're going to be judged harshly, and usually they're beating themselves up for even being ill. The external stigma, which is the actual sort of discrimination that they encounter in the medical workplace. And that's why I raised the point of medical licensure. We haven't got, all the states vary. There's a huge number of states now who do not separate any questions about psychiatric illness out from any medical questions. So that's a good thing. And the other thing, too, is that there are some states that aren't asking any questions at all. And what we've actually been recommending is that the questions that are acceptable to ask and don't violate the Americans with Disability Act are only ones that inquire into current functioning. So therefore, a question is something like, are you currently living with any type of illness that could be affecting your safety or competence to practice medicine? And if so, please explain. Okay, so therefore, that would eliminate individuals who have been ill in the past, but they've gone for care, they're well. It would eliminate the ones who haven't missed a day's work and stuff like that. They could answer no to that question. And that would be much, much less intimidating, because it's extremely scary for people who have, you know, come forward, gotten help, and then they really worry that they're going to be penalized for having done something that was really life-saving. And so we feel very strongly about this, that those questions all have to be reworked. So the Federation of State Medical Boards is actually examining this. And to my knowledge, they're recommending a universal template that hopefully will be adopted by all of the medical boards across the nation.
So these are the, I guess, 26 different medical boards that govern the various medical specialties. But this federation has these sort of universal rules that they can try to apply or push out to their different societies.
Yeah, this is the federation of all the state medical programs across the country. Because, as I say, licensure does vary from state to state, the questions that are asked. And that's why then some individuals are terrified to even go for help. They try to, you know, they try to tough it out, that sort of thing. And that, you know, if they're really quite ill, that can be very dangerous. And that was the thing that terrified me the most as I did all of these interviews for this book, listening to these heart-wrenching stories from bereaved families who pleaded with their physician loved one to go for help, and he or she refused to because they were so afraid of any possible fallout. And next thing you know, the individual was dead by suicide. And that to me is heartbreaking, and it's unconscionable.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Michael Myers. He is a professor of clinical psychiatry at SUNY. That's the State University of New York Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. And he's the author of the just-released book, Why Physicians Die by Suicide. And Dr. Myers, what are some of the theories about why doctors commit suicide more than the general population?
Yes, I think what we're learning is that depression is diagnosed a little bit more commonly in physicians. You know, when you look at that, though, could it mean that there are people out there, though, that just aren't being diagnosed? But it's felt, though, that, you know, that it's a very real illness and that we can be prone to it in medicine. So that's the one thing. Our rates of substance use and overuse, which can be factors contributing to suicide in doctors as well, are really about the same as the general public. And then there's a bunch of other things, like PTSD. There are doctors who are walking around with post-traumatic stress disorder who aren't even aware of it, actually, because a lot of it is emanating from their work. But other times it's had to do with maybe some personal or family experiences they've had and that sort of thing, but it can really affect them. Burnout can also, in its worst form, can also precipitate suicidality in physicians. And the other thing are medical illnesses that are chronic and debilitating, where the physician decides that he or she just isn't going to live with it anymore. And then we get into an idea that's more like rational suicide, but yet those physicians can indeed be at risk of harming themselves. But what the bottom line is that I believe very strongly that the vast majority of physicians who are taking their lives each year are dying of treatable psychiatric illnesses.
And you also make the point that physicians I guess, particularly have this specialized medical knowledge about how to do it and whether that's true or not. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Yes, that's considered another risk factor for us in medicine. And by the way, not just us in medicine. It would fit for pharmacists. It would fit for dentists, for veterinarians. You know, whenever you know something about toxicology, and whenever you've treated, as we do in medicine, we've treated patients who have made attempts on their life by various means, you acquire kind of ideas of how you would end your life if you ever got that desperate. And in my work as a doctor's doctor, looking after seriously depressed physicians who trust me enough to open up to me and let me enter that dark world of theirs, the suicide plans and thoughts that those depressed doctors have are really quite profound, because they want to make sure that they do it right. In other words, that it indeed will be lethal. And many of them make statements to me, I don't want to blow it. I've looked after too many botched suicide attempts in my life as an ER doc or as a psychiatrist or as a surgeon or as a intensivist, et cetera, et cetera. So they can be very strategic in their planning and how they might do it. And that's why, you know, I urge anybody who's looking after doctors and you're doing a suicide risk assessment, sure, you ask about firearms, but make sure you ask whether or not they might be self-prescribing or stockpiling the medicine that you've prescribed for them at home, or that they've stolen dangerous chemicals like narcotics or insulin, potassium chloride, et cetera, from the hospital that they know by injection will kill them.
So, Dr. Myers, you have alluded to the fact that you're a doctor's doctor. That is, you've spent much, it sounds like, of your career, or all of it, caring for professionals, many of whom are impaired with mental illnesses or depression or substance abuse. Is that really what inspired you to write this book, or was there a particular story?
Thank you for asking that, because it's kind of evolved. I've written a lot of books and papers on physician health. But the culmination, I produced a videotape in 1998 on physician suicide, and it got some press and it got distributed around the world. But I wanted to do something where the voices of people who are the bereaved loved ones of doctors, their family members, their students, their professors, their colleagues, their training directors, and I also interviewed some patients who lost their doctors to suicide. And that's really the substance of the book, because I felt that their voices had to be heard, because we've known for some time a lot about the risk factors and the illnesses and the things that we got to be treating. But I thought there's got to be more here. And so to capture all of that has been really a very humbling and moving exercise. And that's why, you know, I put it into this book. And see, what that culminated was I finished my training in 1973. And I've always had a half-time private practice. And for the first 10 years, or 10 to 15 years, I was a generalist. But I began to increasingly see physicians in my private practice. And I got so busy that for the last 20 years of my practice, I only looked after medical students and doctors and their family members. So that's how this has all evolved into kind of getting, you know, a rich amount of experience with physicians so that I could, you know, put it in book form.
Now, you also tell the story at the outset of a roommate of yours from medical school, and those times were much different. There was almost literally nothing said and nothing done in memory of this student. Can you share a little bit about that with us?
Yes, in fact, this past year, well, it would be a year ago now, I went back to my 50th reunion from medical school, and I was asked to give an address, and I basically dedicated my remarks to Bill, my roommate. That's a pseudonym, by the way. And he and I were roommates, and I didn't pick up anything. I was the last person, certainly in our class or whatever, to see him alive. Went off for the Thanksgiving weekend, and he didn't come back. And I was told by the landlady that she had received a call from the family that he'd killed himself over the Thanksgiving weekend. And, I mean, I was just stunned. I mean, I was only 19. I couldn't believe it. But when you refer to what it was like then, back in 1962, it was really it was as if Bill didn't exist. I made the announcement to my class, but we heard nothing from anybody in the medical institution, nothing from the dean. Nobody spoke to us. We all just buried ourselves in our studies. And that's kind of the way we got through it all. It's so different now, you know, when a medical student dies by suicide today, and it's much healthier today, too, that there is a whole postvention and et cetera, et cetera. But back then, and also that was before the so-called enlightened age of medicine. And what I mean by that, back in those days and before, if a doctor or medical student sort of became ill and maybe had to take a leave or whatever, it was sort of seen as they weren't fit for medicine, that it might have been a mistake letting them into the field, that they were kind of like a weak duckling or something. I mean, I look back, it's a shameful era, actually, in the history of medicine, but yet it was very much that way. It was basically survival of the fittest, and we're so much more enlightened now and so much more humane, thank goodness.
You have a co-author, not of this book, but a previous book of yours, who wrote the foreword, Carla Fine. She's someone it sounds like you've collaborated with over the course of your career. Tell us a little bit about her and what led you to work together.
She's become one of my best friends in my personal life, as well as a major collaborator in lectures that we do together, as well as in much of our writing. Carla is the widow of a urologist who killed himself in 1989. And her book, No Time to Say Goodbye, is basically her story. She really couldn't find much at all in the bereavement literature that was unique to suicide. And she was already a writer, so she wrote the book. And her book has been very well received throughout the world. I think it's translated into about 8 different languages, and I think it's in its 19th printing or something like that. It really captures what it was like for her to lose her husband, and also a lot of the stigma that existed even then. And she's an example of somebody who pleaded with her husband to go for help, and being a urologist, and he reluctantly went, but yet he dropped out, and he didn't really get involved with it. But even in the aftermath, she describes so painfully the stigma associated with the families that are left behind. She described people crossing the street when they saw her coming along. There were very few doctors from Harry's medical center who came to his funeral, even though he was a highly regarded academic urologist. And it just spoke to the sort of shame or discrimination that was associated with physician suicide then. That's quite a few years ago, and I think we're further along than that. But even today, though, when somebody loses someone to suicide, first of all, it's a very different kind of bereavement, but they feel very, very stigmatized. And so, again, in my teaching, I try to get those messages out there as well, that these individuals have to be treated with the same respect and kindness and compassion as we would anyone else who had suffered any other kind of bereavement.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Michael Myers, professor of clinical psychiatry at SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York, and he's written the new book, Why Physicians Die by Suicide, and they do so at a greater rate than the general population. Dr. Myers, you mentioned that you were telling the story of these survivors through often their loved ones or others. I guess it's interesting in the book, you know, you were pretty brave about reaching out to people that you read about, or I guess if I had to guess, I'd say you sort of collected a file of various news stories or things you'd heard about over the years, and then you sort of reached out. I guess, how did people feel when you just sort of called them up out of the blue and said, you know, I'm a psychiatrist, I work on this stuff, and or maybe I'm writing a book, or how exactly did you frame it?
Okay, thank you for that, because it was with mixed results. I started out with a database that I already had of some families that I knew, and it was through those families, and that they knew of other families who had lost a physician loved one to suicide, so therefore they would kind of make an introduction, so to speak, by email or by telephone or whatever. And so those would be easier ones, because those people really had a chance to think, do I want to talk to this guy or not? However, the ones that did elect to be interviewed by me, though I want to believe from the feedback that I got from them, but it certainly wasn't universal, that they actually found it helpful in many ways, not just to kind of revisit, you know, some of the pain, but there was this sort of sense that, first of all, they needed to talk. They wanted to talk with somebody where they certainly didn't feel judged. And thirdly, they had this universal message that if by telling my story I can prevent one death of another physician or whatever, then I will feel that my husband, my son, my daughter, my mother will not have died in vain. So those are individuals who are really gracious, and I think that's an amazing gift that they've given, you know, to the world of medicine. There were others, though, that really didn't want me to go forward with their stories, which was fine. And there were many too. I gave them an option as to a release. They all signed a release, of course, but with regard to whether or not they wanted their name disclosed, there were certainly some people who did, and they felt very strongly that they wanted their name to be associated with the story because they're quite public about this and they're very committed to making a difference. But most of the others preferred not to identify themselves. And that was fine. And, of course, and that's when I've used pseudonyms and disguised a lot of the details. But overall, I mean, I have such enormous respect for them. And as I say, I think that they see me. You know, having worked in a stigmatized branch of medicine my entire career in psychiatry, I've known for a long time that I need to be the spokesperson for people who cannot speak for themselves often because of stigma. So therefore, I do it, and I'm glad to do it, and I'm proud to do it. So a lot of this is really what drives me, to get these very important life-saving messages out there.
There was, I think, one story you related where I think one of the survivors corresponded with you by email, and then you had, I think, wanted to reach out, but for some reason or another didn't connect, and then ultimately you found out she also committed suicide?
That was so sad. That was so very sad. I was notified by her when her medical student daughter died by suicide. She had written a book to basically honor her daughter, and she was distributing the book, you know, around to various medical schools. And so I read about this, so I got in touch with her immediately. We had a very nice and long conversation. It was just before, it was the day before the death of her daughter when she and I spoke. And she wanted, you know, to pick this up again, not at that time because of some other things that were going on in her life. And then it was several months later that when I hadn't heard from her, when I heard from somebody else doing this kind of work that she had taken her own life, I was just absolutely stunned and I just felt so sorrowful. As the mother, she disclosed that she herself had struggled with depression through her lifetime, and her daughter was aware of this, but she knew nothing of her own daughter's struggle with depression. In fact, she and her husband only learned about her daughter's sort of internal journey in the suicide note after her death.
Oh my gosh.
It was a very, very sad.
Well, when we were setting up this interview, you know, I alluded to the fact that this is a difficult topic for many, whether you're a survivor of suicide or whether you work in the field or just if you are, I guess, lucky enough not to have come into contact with suicide, just sometimes hearing about it or reading about it is something you may almost have a superstitious aversion to. So you reminded me that there are notes of hope. What are some of the solutions to this high number of suicides in the health, the healing professions?
Yeah, there's a lot going on. I am really so grateful that it's certainly not just from this, because there's so much other research going on in the world of physician health and, you know, studies of burnout and depression and anxiety, et cetera, et cetera. So going from a sort of organizational and national level, I've been active in the Accreditation Council of Graduate Medical Education, and they've had two full symposia, and that was sparked by the two suicide deaths of interns here in New York City in August of 2014. And that was because they died within a week of each other. there's been a national response to their deaths. So the ACGME, which is the accrediting body for residents, is really looking at this very seriously. There's all kinds of work groups that have been set up throughout the country, and they've extended their reach beyond residents and fellows to physicians in general and to into medical schools as well. I'm going to Washington, D.C. on Wednesday to a half-day symposium where I'm presenting my work on suicide in medical students. There's going to be a large group of people there who work in dean's offices, associate deans, things like that. See, there's a lot of stuff going on in our medical schools to kind of make the training and passage through medical school healthier, because it should be. I mean, it's stressful, as we all know, but it's so sad and tragic that, you know, that young people in medical school or residency training are losing, you know, are losing their lives. And so that's just two sort of cohorts. In the world beyond that, in everything too, the American Medical Association is taking up initiatives. The National Academy of Medicine, I just was on a webinar of theirs 2 weeks ago. They're looking at this from so many different perspectives as well, to look at the workplace to make it healthier, the way we practice medicine, how frustrating it is for doctors dealing with insurance companies, for instance, or malpractice litigation, or just the volume of their work, or accreditation. Oh, by the way, the other thing, too, earlier we were talking about medical board licensure. We also need to look at credentialing committees of various medical institutions, because some of the questions they're asking are very intrusive, too. And so they need to be, a lot of them need to be revamped. So there's that piece. And then at a more micro level, doctors themselves now are forming, well, like support groups. That's why I put a section in the back about so-called balance groups that started in England decades ago. But they're basically where doctors can just kind of get support from each other so that they're not so isolated and alone. And what I'm doing with my own, in my own branch of medicine, and I was just talking, I'm on a sort of advisory committee to the group that's looking at this in the American Psychiatric Association, is a way too that we can try to make it easier for physicians, first of all, to go for help, but secondly, when they do come to see us, I really think that we need to be really on our toes. I taught a course for over 20 years at the American Psychiatric Association annual meeting called Treating Medical Students and Physicians, because there are some specifics that are extremely important that you really have to make sure that you follow. Because if you don't, the doctor or patient can fall through the cracks. And that's another risk factor for suicide in doctors. If they don't get the same kind of treatment that they deserve, that the general public gets. So that's the short answer to a lot of good things that are going on to, you know, to hopefully to prevent suicide, to, you know, to make the practice of medicine sort of more joyful again.
Yeah, there's definitely been a lot that I read and think about with regard to, you know, finding meaning in the work and continuing to find meaning, of course. And then, as you point out, joyful medical practice. I've seen several articles titled that way. Well, it's a very poignant book, and it's called Why Physicians Die by Suicide, Lessons Learned from Their Families and Others Who Cared. And it's by my guest today, Dr. Michael Myers, who is a professor of clinical psychiatry at SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. Dr. Myers, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, John. I really appreciate this opportunity to be on your show. Thank you very much.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.